My guest at this time is Richard Miniter, investigative reporter and best-selling author. His latest book is Eyes on Target, Inside Stories from the Brotherhood of the U.S. Navy SEALs. And, Rich, it's great to have you in studio. Thanks.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
This book is making some headlines on a number of fronts. Let's start with the revelations and the insight that you and your co-author, Scott McEwen, have made on Benghazi. Still a lot of outstanding questions there and a lot of debate about how serious the administration's mishandling of this really was. There's a lot of talk, of course, about whether or not there were orders to stand down, and there's certainly requests made for action to be taken, but there's also seems to be a lot of simple inaction here. So which struck you more?
Well, let's talk about the big news that's in the book in the Benghazi chapter. We discovered three intelligence reports that circulated in the months before the attack. And each of those three reports, which we quote extensively in Eyes on Target, each of those three reports show intelligence agencies warning the State Department, warning the Defense Department, there's an Al-Qaeda buildup in Benghazi. One of those reports included photographs of more than 300 Al-Qaeda operatives in Martyrs Square. That's downtown Benghazi. That's less than a mile from the diplomatic outpost where the ambassador died on September 11th, 2012. In those photographs in the intelligence report, they show them waving guns. And there's a quote from that's mentioned in this intelligence report, in which the leader of Al-Qaeda in Benghazi said that if the U.S. doesn't leave, they were going to kill the U.S. ambassador. Greg, you can't get any clearer than that. Those warnings were out there. We found those three intelligence reports. They're in this book, Eyes on Target. And they show you that the State Department, somewhere in the bowels of the State Department, there's a bureaucrat who's got the three intelligence reports. And on the other part of his desk, he's got the three or four security requests from the ambassador begging for more security guards. And after reading those intelligence reports and seeing those pictures, he stamped each one of those, denied, denied, denied. In fact, on August 29th, 2012, we learned that just a few days before the ambassador was killed, that's when the last of the security detail, Blue Mountain Libya, was pulled from the diplomatic outpost there in Benghazi.
A lot of the speculation centers around the fact that the attack happened just less than 2 months before a presidential election, which could go against the theme that Al-Qaeda's on the run and the threat's over. And, of course, the administration led the assault to remove Gaddafi from power in Libya. But in comparison to the calculation of how an attack like the one that played out would look in the American press, why did they end up deciding to deny the request rather than just quietly approving them?
Well, you know, that's exactly the question we asked several Benghazi eyewitnesses. And what they told us was that they were concerned that if somehow the American public were to learn that there was additional security for the ambassador or the diplomatic staff in Benghazi, it would take away the two winning arguments that they thought they had on foreign policy. One, that, hey, we liberated Libya, we defeated Gaddafi. And two, we've killed bin Laden and Al-Qaeda's on the run. So if they admitted that there was a massive Al-Qaeda buildup in Libya, that crosses off their two foreign policy successes and undermines the president's case for reelection. So as crassly political as it was, that appears to be the motivation, according to the Benghazi eyewitnesses. These are participants in the tragedy that we interviewed.
And another very interesting part of this book is the five different rescue or relief scenarios here, two of which involved either naval or Air Force aviators coming out of bases in Italy. There was the drone possibility, cruise missiles from the Mediterranean. And all of these would have been too late to save the problem at the consulate. But in terms of the fighting at the annex that raged on for hours, from the experts that you talked to, which was the most plausible and most likely effective scenario if any of them had actually been employed?
Well, Greg, you put your finger on the red-hot issue here, the stand-down order and what could have been done. The battle in Benghazi raged for more than 8 hours. Now, the ambassador and his attaché, Sean Smith, died within the first 30 to 45 minutes. But the other two, Ty Woods and Glenn Daugherty, didn't die for another 6.5 to 7 hours. Aviano, the U.S. Naval facility there, other naval air stations in Italy, and the aircraft carrier that we discovered was on station. There was a U.S. aircraft carrier in Italy there to commemorate the September 11th attacks on New York and Washington in 2001. Well, on September 11th, 2012, it's there in Italy with a full complement of fighter jets. What we did is we searched for, interviewed F-16 fighter pilots, a SEAL team assault leader, and other people, people who specialize in designing rescue missions for diplomats under siege, exactly what was going on in Benghazi. And we said, based on the equipment that was available at the time, based on the geography, we interviewed people who'd have flown those flights before, who've planned those rescue missions before, and they laid out five plausible rescue scenarios. The scenario that seems the best is simply dispatching F-16 fighters from Italy and having them fly over Benghazi, and the loud jet roar overhead would be enough to scatter the attackers. And they certainly know that when facing the U.S. Air Force or U.S. Navy in the sky, death comes from above. With more than 100 attackers, mortars, rocket attacks, they would know that they're the targets. And they would have, without firing a shot, they could have been driven off. That's the kind of thing that President Obama, who doesn't like combat, would tend to favor. But there are other scenarios as well. We looked at the drone activity overhead. They're too detailed to go into now, but they're in the book, Eyes on Target.
Let's talk about ultimately who's responsible here. From what you report in the book and other media accounts, President Obama had a conversation with Secretary Panetta somewhere in the early evening, Washington time, and at that point, we don't have any other record of him being engaged in this. So ultimately, did he leave a standing order? Did Leon Panetta decide that once everything went down at the consulate that there wasn't reason for a military mission? Who's ultimately responsible for not sending relief?
Well, while Americans were fighting and dying in Benghazi, the president was unreachable. According to congressional testimony, Panetta's last conversation with the president was before 6:30 p.m. Washington time. And remember, Glenn Doherty and Ty Woods, the two SEALs who fought to save the Americans, wouldn't die for another almost 7 hours. And in that period, the president disappeared. He refused to take calls. Interestingly, the White House did issue one press release that night. And that was a press release about the president's hour-and-a-half conversation with the Israeli prime minister, having nothing to do with Benghazi, but putting out a political fire for the president, who was worried that he was going to lose significant support for Americans from Americans who favor Israel. So while Americans were fighting and dying, President Obama was on the phone, according to the White House, for an hour-and-a-half with the Israeli prime minister.
Where does this go from here? Obviously, you've got the administration saying that there is no scandal here. You've got pretty much a partisan back and forth about whether there's really major responsibility here and whether Secretary of State at the time, Hillary Clinton, deserves a lot of blame. So is this just going to end up being a political back and forth, or ultimately is one version of this history going to emerge?
Ultimately, I think this is going to be a turning point in the country's assessment of the president. The media, which are, they're supposed to be referees, but instead they're on the field being players. And too many of the media are simply playing to the White House's agenda. And really, they should be watchdogs, not lapdogs. And I think what we've seen with Cheryl Atkinson, the CBS reporter, who was the only one in broadcast media, a major network broadcast media, who was willing to cover this story on a regular basis, well, she just had to resign her job, citing bias at CBS. It just shows you the degree of integration and bias. By the way, when Cheryl Atkinson had to leave CBS, the president of CBS is the brother of a high-ranking Obama administration White House official.
Rich Miniter is an award-winning investigative reporter and best-selling author of the new book, Eyes on Target, written with co-author Scott McEwen. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.